Welcome to our deep dive, everybody. Today, we're going to be exploring The Lean Startup by Eric Ries.
It's a fantastic book.
Oh, yeah. It's been called like the innovation roadmap, right, for the 21st century.
It really has. Yeah. I think folks like IDEO CEO Tim Brown said that.
Yeah.
And it's even, changed the way that big companies like Intuit approach innovation.
It's a big deal. And whether you're, you know, dreaming up a business or even tackling a personal goal, there's a lot to learn here.
A lot of great stuff.
So let's jump right in. You know, one of the most powerful ideas in this book is that entrepreneurship isn't just about executing a plan, right?
Yeah,
it's about learning, like embracing the unknown and making learning your most valuable tool.
Yeah, it's really a complete shift in mindset from traditional management, you know, where it's all about making a plan and executing it flawlessly.
Right.
The lean startup approach really says no. You have to be ready to adapt, to evolve based on what you discover along the way.
So instead of getting penalized, you know, for a missed target, you know, a lean startup founder, you know, they see it as a chance to understand, like, why they missed and course correct.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I imagine a traditional manager missing a deadline, they'd be sweating bullets.
Yeah.
But a lean startup founder would be digging into the data, trying to figure out what went wrong, why the delay. How can we prevent this next time? And this isn't just for, you know, brand new companies either. We're talking big companies like Intuit using these principles to stay agile.
Yeah. So instead of just diving right into action, you know, the lean startup approach, it kind of encourages us to step back a second. Think about what assumptions we're making. Are we building something people actually want?
Yeah. And Ries illustrates this really well with the story of his first company, IMDU.
Okay.
And they had this this grand vision, right? They were going to create this 3D avatar-based IM add-on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, avatars back then, they were all the rage.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were totally convinced they had a hit on their hands.
But customers weren't exactly lining up, were they?
Nope, not at all. They were met with crickets chirping, you know. Their grand plans just fell flat.
Wow.
Because it turned out their assumptions about how people actually used IM, they were just totally wrong.
So it's about this idea of validated learning that really resonated with me. It's not just about theories and opinions. It's about getting that real world feedback.
Yeah, it's the difference between guessing what people want and actually watching what they do.
Like Zappos did in the early days, right?
Oh, yeah.
Instead of building like this massive infrastructure for selling shoes online, they decided to run an experiment.
Mm-hmm.
They just posted pictures of shoes from local stores on this really basic website.
Yep.
Just to see if anyone would actually, you know, bite.
That's right. And it was a brilliant move, right?
Yeah.
Validate the demand before investing tons of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a great reminder that we often, jump into action before we really understand, like, the problem that we're trying to solve.
We sure do.
So, you know, before you pour your heart and soul into your next big idea, think about how you can apply this. How can you test your assumptions in a way that's low risk, low cost?
Right.
Figure out, you know, what people actually want. Now, this leads us to one of the best known ideas from the lean startup, the MVP. Minimum viable product.
The MVP.
And it's not about building something that's like half baked or incomplete.
No, no, no.
It's about being laser focused. Like, what's the absolute minimum you need to build to start learning, to start gathering that feedback?
Exactly.
Like Dropbox, for example. They had this vision for seamless file syncing, but the technology behind it was really complex. So what'd they do?
They made a video.
A video MVP.
The video MVP.
It was brilliant.
Right.
Such a simple way to show the value of the product before the actual technology was even, you know, totally finished.
And it worked.
Yeah. Fantastic example of how a simple MVP can help you validate your assumptions, generate buzz before you invest a ton of money in development.
For sure.
And there's another great example, Food on the Table, the meal planning service.
Oh, yeah. I love that example.
They started with what Ries calls a concierge MVP. So before building their fancy algorithm, they were literally just manually creating shopping lists.
Yeah, for individual customers.
For individual customers.
Yeah.
Just to understand, like, their needs and their pain points in a way that that no survey or focus group ever could.
Exactly.
So, you know, these examples show us how the MVP concept can be applied to so much more than just tech products, right? So let's say your goal is, I don't know, let's say you want to write a novel.
Yeah.
Your MVP might be like writing a short story, you know, or even just a detailed outline to test your ideas, to get feedback from beta readers.
I like it.
And, you know, it's about finding the minimum effort required to test your assumptions, gather feedback before you invest a ton of time and resources.
Yep.
Now building and testing, that's great, but how do we know if we're really making progress? You know, traditional business metrics like total customers or revenue can be misleading.
Yeah, especially for startups.
Especially for startups.
That's why Rees introduces this concept of innovation accounting.
Okay.
And it's about focusing on these actionable metrics that really track your progress towards validating those make or break assumptions.
Mm. So instead of focusing on vanity metrics.
Yeah, you've got to identify the metrics that matter.
Ones that really matter.
Exactly. Like, I imagine you're trying to reach a fitness goal, right?
Okay.
Would you focus on how many hours you spend at the gym?
Probably not.
Or would you look at, you know, actual changes in your body composition?
Ah.
Innovation accounting, it's all about those metrics that reflect real progress.
Yeah.
Not just, you know, meaningless activity.
Yeah, like Grokket, the online test prep platform.
Right.
They learned this the hard way. They're obsessed with vanity metrics.
Mm.
You know, like the total number of questions answered on the platform.
Yeah, which led them to work on features that didn't actually move the needle. They were busy.
Right.
But not making meaningful progress.
Yeah, it's like running on a treadmill. You're expending all this energy, but you're not actually going anywhere. So how do we know when to stay the course and when to, change direction?
Well, that is the million-dollar question for any entrepreneur, right?
Yeah.
It's the pivot or persevere dilemma.
And one of the toughest decisions to make.
It really is.
Ronsis emphasizes, though, that a pivot isn't a failure, right?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
It's a sign that you're adaptable.
Mm.
It's acknowledging that your initial hypothesis might have been wrong.
Mm.
And you're making a change based on what you've learned.
A course correction.
Exactly.
And to illustrate this, let's look at the story of Votizen, which later became At2Gov.
Okay.
They started as a social network for voters.
Okay.
But they had to go through a whole series of pivots before finding a model that worked.
That's right. So their first version, you know, it attracted some early adopters.
Uh-huh.
But engagement was low. People just weren't coming back.
Right.
So David Benetti, the founder.
Yeah.
He had a tough choice. Stick with the plan or pivot.
And he chose to pivot?
He did.
Uh-huh.
They decided to focus on this one key feature, this tool that let activists connect with registered voters.
Okay.
And that became, you know, the core of their new offering. But, you know, even with engagement going up, they still weren't making enough money.
Right.
So they had to pivot again. This time, they went to a self-serve platform model.
And that was a pretty risky move.
It was.
Right.
But it finally led them to a sustainable model for growth.
So Votizen's story shows us just how important it is to use data to make these decisions.
Absolutely.
About pivoting or persevering. You know, what metrics are crucial for your goals?
Yeah.
And how can you use those metrics to guide your decisions?
All about the data.
And remember, pivoting, it doesn't always mean starting from scratch.
No.
Sometimes it's just about repurposing what you've already built.
Right.
Applying those learnings to a new approach.
What?
Maybe even a whole new market.
Okay.
Take Wealthfront, for example.
Okay.
They were initially building this platform, you know, for amateur investors to compete with each other.
Yeah.
But they realized, like, that their target audience just, they weren't interested.
Hmm.
But what they learned through that process, it led them to this whole new discovery,
right,
that professional money managers were actually, you know, open to a platform that offered greater transparency and access to new investors.
Right.
And that became the foundation for their success.
Yeah. Amazing example.
It is. It's an example of how a pivot can unlock these unexpected opportunities, right?
Yeah,
it can. Yeah. And how crucial it is to be open to that feedback, even when it challenges your initial assumptions. So as we wrap up this first part of our deep dive,
okay,
remember, pivoting, it's not giving up. It's a testament to your commitment to learning.
To adapting.
And in this ever-changing world of innovation, That's a superpower.
It really is.
But hold on tight, because in the next part, we're going to explore how lean startups scale and grow without sacrificing that crucial agility.
It's going to be good.
It's about to get even more interesting.
Can't wait. So, you know, we've talked about how crucial learning and adapting are in the lean startup world.
Yeah.
But how do these principles apply as a company starts to grow?
Mm.
You know, you might think that growth means things inevitably get, well, slower.
Yeah.
More bogged down in bureaucracy.
Yeah, you would think so. Scaling up, you know, it brings up images of like endless meetings and red tape, right?
But Rees, he kind of flips that notion on its head.
Okay.
He introduces this concept that he borrows from the manufacturing world.
Mm-hmm.
The power of small batches.
Mm, interesting. So how does making things in smaller batches lead to faster growth?
Well, think about it like this.
Yeah.
Imagine you're putting together a piece of furniture, something mm. really complex, right?
Okay.
You could try to put all the parts together at once, but what if you make a mistake early on?
Ooh, yeah.
You might have to like take apart a huge chunk of it just to fix it.
That sounds really frustrating.
It is.
Yeah.
And that's the problem with the large batch approach,
yeah.
right? It seems efficient at first, but it often leads to a lot of wasted time and effort in the long run.
Yeah, I can see that.
So working in smaller batches, it allows you to catch those errors, you know, earlier
uh-huh.
and make adjustments much more easily.
So it's like you're building in these mini feedback loops throughout the entire process.
Exactly. And this is actually a core principle of the Toyota production system. You know,
oh, yeah.
The thing that transformed the manufacturing industry.
Yeah, Toyota is known for being like incredibly efficient.
Oh yeah.
So they use this this small batch approach to build cars faster and with higher quality.
That's right. They found that working in these smaller batches, it let them produce a wider variety of cars with fewer defects, and it was cheaper.
Hmm. So how does that translate to the world of startups? Are there examples of companies that have used this small batch philosophy successfully?
Oh, absolutely. You know, IMVU, the company Eric Rees co-founded, they adopted this model of continuous deployment.
Wow.
So instead of, you know, releasing these big infrequent updates to their product, they were pushing out small updates sometimes even multiple times a day.
Wow.
Based on real-time feedback from their customers.
Multiple updates per day? That sounds incredibly fast-paced.
It is, but it allowed them to be super responsive to what their customers needed.
Yeah.
And to iterate really quickly without, you know, getting bogged down in these lengthy development cycles.
It's like they were constantly experimenting, constantly learning.
They were.
But how do you manage that level of rapid iteration, like without introducing bugs and errors?
Well, that's where automated testing comes in.
Yeah.
You know, IMVU, they had this sophisticated system of automated tests
mm.
so that each little update wouldn't break anything in the existing product.
Ah, so it's like creating a safety net for experimentation.
Exactly.
So they were able to move fast without breaking things. That's impressive. So is this small batch approach only for software companies?
Not at all. Even hardware development is getting faster and more iterative, you know, thanks to things like 3D printing and rapid prototyping. You know, Ridges actually shares the story of this company called SGW Design Works. They make these portable X-ray machines.
Oh.
And they were tasked with developing a foldable X-ray machine.
Mm.
So something that could be easily transported, which is a pretty complex engineering challenge.
Yeah, I can imagine designing a foldable X-ray machine. That's no easy feat.
It's not. But instead of going through the traditional process of building these expensive physical prototypes,
good.
they turned to 3D modeling.
Ah, okay.
And this allowed them to create virtual prototypes, get feedback, and iterate on the design so much faster.
And cheaper, probably.
And cheaper. It's a fraction of the cost.
So they essentially brought that small batch iterative mindset to a traditionally hardware-focused industry.
Yeah.
It's amazing how technology is kind of like blurring the lines between different types of development these days.
It is. And it really highlights, you know, how important it is to embrace that experimental mindset no matter what industry you're in.
Yeah. So this small batch approach, it also kind of challenges that traditional model of functional specialization.
It does.
You know, where different departments work in silos.
Yeah, you know, you've got the design team over here, the engineering team over there, the marketing team.
Yeah.
All working in their own little bubbles.
Yeah. And that can be a recipe for disaster.
It can. Rees calls it the large batch death spiral.
Ooh, that sounds ominous.
It is. Each department, they get so focused on their own tasks, right, that they lose sight of the bigger picture, the overall customer experience.
So you end up with a product that's been, you know, meticulously designed and engineered and marketed.
Right.
But by the time it actually reaches the customer, it's already outdated.
Exactly. And that's why Rees really advocates for this more integrated approach, where teams work together in smaller batches, constantly, you know, testing and iterating based on that real world feedback. It's about breaking down those silos, you know, creating a culture of continuous learning and improvement.
I love that. This makes perfect sense. But it also raises another question.
Okay.
With so many things happening at once, how do we know what to prioritize?
That is a great question.
How do we make sure that we're working on the right things?
Well, that's where the principle of pull, don't push comes in.
Okay, break that down for me. What's the difference between pulling and pushing?
All right, so imagine you're a chef in a restaurant.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
In a push system, you'd be preparing a large batch of every dish on the menu.
Hoping that customers order it.
Hoping that customers order it.
Yeah. You'd probably end up with a lot of wasted food if certain dishes aren't, you know, popular.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now imagine a pull system where you only prepare a dish when a customer actually orders it.
Mm-hmm.
You're responding to actual demand, not anticipating it.
Ah, that's much more efficient.
It is.
So how does this apply to product development?
Well, instead of building features because you think customers might want them, you focus on the features that they're actually asking for.
Okay.
You let customer demand pull the development process.
So you're essentially letting the market guide your product roadmap.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, Rees talks about this clean energy company called Alphabet Energy.
Okay.
And they're developing these thermoelectric generators. They can convert waste heat into electricity.
That sounds like an incredibly innovative technology.
It is. But, you know, instead of trying to guess which industries would be most interested, they took this pull approach.
Okay.
They built these small-scale prototypes, and they took them directly to potential customers and said, hey, what problems are you facing? How can we help?
So they were letting the market tell them where their technology was most needed.
Exactly. And it allowed them to avoid wasting time on features that weren't in demand.
Yeah.
And really tailor their solutions to the specific needs of their customers.
It's a really smart way to take the guesswork out of innovation.
That is.
So we've got these small batches, you know, cooking. We're letting customer demand guide our development. But how do we know which engine of growth to focus on?
Well, that's where Riss's framework for analyzing different growth engines comes in.
Mm.
You know, he identifies four primary engines: sticky, viral, paid, and then the combination of paid and viral.
Let's dive into those. What are the key characteristics of each one?
All right, so a sticky engine is all about customer retention.
Okay.
So companies like Netflix or Spotify, they fall into this category.
Okay.
Their goal is to create a product that people love and keep coming back to.
So their metrics focus on things like churn rate and customer lifetime value.
Exactly. And then there's the viral engine, where growth is driven by word of mouth and network effects.
Yeah.
So think about companies like Facebook or Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Their success really depends on people, you know, inviting their friends and expanding that network.
The power of going viral. So what metric is most important for a viral engine?
Well, the key metric there is the viral coefficient.
Okay.
Which measures how many new customers each existing customer brings in.
So the higher the viral coefficient, the faster the growth.
Exactly. Then we've got the paid engine,
which
relies on advertising and other forms of paid customer acquisition.
Okay.
So this is like e-commerce companies, SaaS businesses. They often fall into this category.
Mm-hmm.
They're using things like Google Ads or Facebook Ads to reach new customers.
So the key here is to make sure that you're not spending more to acquire a customer than you're making from them.
You got it. That the crucial metric there is the cost per acquisition, or CPA,
okay,
compared to that customer lifetime value.
Yeah.
And finally, there's the combination of paid and viral.
So that's when a company uses both paid acquisition and viral loops to kind of accelerate their growth.
Exactly. And a great example of this is Dropbox.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
They use that viral video MVP that we talked about earlier to generate buzz.
Uh-huh.
But they also invested in paid advertising, you know, to reach a wider audience.
It's a powerful combination.
It is.
So we've covered small batches, the pull approach, and growth engines. Now the question is, how do you maintain that startup spirit as the company grows, you know?
That's the big question, isn't it?
How do you avoid becoming slow and bureaucratic?
And it's exactly what we'll unpack in the final part of our deep dive.
All right, so we've talked about small batches, validated learning, you know, finding the right engine for growth. But now let's talk about the challenge of keeping that startup energy going even as a company starts to scale.
Yeah.
How do we prevent, you know, the dreaded bureaucracy from taking over?
It's a challenge for sure. But Rees gives us a framework. He calls it building the adaptive organization.
Okay.
And it's about creating a culture that embraces, you know, continuous learning, experimentation, being able to adapt even as you grow bigger.
So how do you actually build this adaptive organization? Like, is there a secret formula?
No magic bullet, unfortunately. But there are some key principles we can follow. First, Rees suggests we rethink the traditional organizational structures.
Okay.
Instead of those big siloed departments.
Right.
He recommends smaller cross-functional teams that are empowered to make decisions and move quickly.
So you're talking about breaking down those walls between departments.
Exactly.
Fostering more collaboration.
It really requires a shift in mindset. You're not optimizing for, you know, individual departments anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the whole build, measure, learn loop.
Right.
The goal is to have everyone focused on learning and adapting, you know, together.
This makes me think about traditional performance reviews.
Yeah.
You know, how they often reward those individual achievements.
Right.
Does that need to change in an adaptive organization?
Absolutely. Maybe. In an adaptive organization, you have to recognize and reward that collective learning, that shared progress.
Okay.
Rees emphasizes, you know, fostering a culture of trust, you know, transparency.
Right.
Where people feel safe sharing their failures and learning from mistakes without being punished for it.
Because, you know, let's face it, mistakes are going to happen.
They are, especially when you're trying new things.
Yeah.
In fact, Rees argues that those failures, they're valuable learning opportunities. It's all about embracing that fail fast, learn fast mentality.
I like that. But how do you actually create that kind of culture? Like, how do you encourage people to take risks and experiment without, you know, feeling like they'll get penalized for it?
Well, one way is to establish really clear learning milestones.
Okay.
So instead of just focusing on whether a team hits specific targets, you evaluate whether they're learning, validating their assumptions.
Oh, okay.
You celebrate that process of discovery, not just the you know, the end result.
So shift the focus from hitting those arbitrary deadlines to actually gaining valuable insights.
Exactly.
Are there specific techniques that teams can use to kind of learn from their mistakes and improve the process?
Yeah, there's one that Rees introduces. It's called the five whys.
The five whys. Okay.
It's deceptively simple, but really powerful.
Mm.
Whenever something goes wrong, like, you know, a missed target or a technical glitch or unexpected customer behavior,
mm-hmm.
you just keep asking why five times.
Oh, so you keep digging deeper.
Deeper and deeper.
Until you find that underlying issue.
That's right. And it helps teams avoid jumping to conclusions or just putting on a Band-Aid.
Mm.
It forces them to really think critically and identify those systemic factors that might be contributing to the problem.
And once they've identified the root cause, then what?
Then it's about making, you know, proportional investments. Don't over-engineer solutions for small problems.
Yeah.
You know, start with small changes and then invest more resources only if the problem keeps coming back.
So a very measured approach to problem solving.
Exactly. And five whys, it can be used for, you know, for processes too.
You're okay.
Rees talks about how IMVU used it to streamline their engineering onboarding process.
Oh, interesting.
Which led to a smoother experience for new hires.
Onboarding can be a huge pain point.
It can.
You know, for the company and for the employee.
Right.
So making that process better can have like a ripple effect.
It really can. You know, those small improvements can often have a big impact.
Yeah, absolutely. So beyond, you know, using tools like the five whys, what else can we do to build this adaptive organization?
Well, Rees really emphasizes empowering teams, you know, giving them the power to make decisions,
yeah,
to act quickly.
So giving them more autonomy, more ownership.
Exactly. And that means giving them the authority and the resources to experiment, to iterate without having to go through a million layers of approval.
Right.
It's about removing roadblocks, you know, and fostering a sense of ownership within the team.
Because nothing kills innovation faster than bureaucracy and red tape.
I couldn't agree more. Rees actually encourages companies to create what he calls innovation sandboxes.
Innovation sandboxes.
Yeah, these protected environments where teams can experiment, test new ideas without, you know, worrying about disrupting the core business.
It's like giving them a safe space to play around.
Exactly. You know, it's about creating a dedicated space within the company where innovation can really flourish.
Yeah.
This is especially important for, you know, those bigger established companies that are trying to stay ahead of the curve.
Makes sense.
Aries points to Intuit as a good example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, despite being a big successful company,
mm-hmm,
they've managed to keep that culture of innovation by embracing these principles.
And it's really inspiring to see how these principles can help companies, big and small, you know, stay agile, stay innovative.
It is. It's really a testament to the power of the lean startup approach.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into the lean startup, what's the key takeaway for our listeners?
I think the biggest takeaway is this. Innovation, it's a journey.
It's not a destination.
It's not a destination. It's not about having all the answers from the start.
Right.
It's about embracing this mindset of continuous learning, you know, experimentation, adaptation.
It's about building a culture that celebrates learning, even when things don't, you know, go exactly according to plan.
Exactly. And these principles, they can apply to more than just businesses, right?
Yeah.
They're relevant to anyone who's trying to create something new, whether it's a product, a project, or even a personal goal.
So as you go out and tackle your next big adventure, remember to embrace that lean startup mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Test your assumptions. Get feedback early and often. Be willing to pivot, you know, when the data tells you to.
That's right.
And remember, that journey of learning, it never ends.
Never does.
Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the lean startup. We hope you've you know, picked up some valuable insights that you can use in your own endeavors.
Yeah, absolutely.
Keep exploring, keep experimenting, and keep innovating.